you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Russ Winter back on the show. Of course, Russ is the host of Winter Watch. Russ, how you doing?
Very good, Tim. I'm really glad to be back on your show. Your show is one of my favorites. And as we were talking about before we came on the air, I think you're really doing some great work. And this is actually my third appearance here, so anybody that's listening to us for the first time, you could go back and we did a show on March 12th of 2018 called Sabbatean Frankist Cult. That one was actually pretty popular, but one of your more popular shows. And then we did another one called The Parasite Guild about banksters on September the 19th if you want to listen to more exchanges between me and Tim.
Well, tonight, or today rather, we're recording daytime, you've run a series of articles on these assassinations, sort of connecting the dots and unraveling, or at least undermining the official narratives of these lone nut assassins, coincidences, they say. One was the McKinley assassination. You write about, Patton's death, which is officially a death caused by an accident. And of course, James Forrestal's suicide, the accident that killed Senator Wellstone. This is sort of the phenomenon of political assassinations. Sometimes they're covered up as sort of a lone nut event, like JFK or McKinley, or rather, sometimes they're covered up by an accident or maybe even natural causes. And we can talk about maybe just the use of assassinations by the crime syndicate. So, Russ,
I think that these particular assassinations are important because they're not all of them are well known. I mean, they're kind of a little bit more obscure, but they really illustrate a lot. They really do. These are topics that, you know, everybody's devoted to JFK, of course, or Martin Luther King or Robert Kennedy, that are in the conspiracy theorist community. But I would broaden it because you're going to get a lot of insights by looking at these particular assassinations. So starting with McKinley, and McKinley was really a key figure, and he was, I think he was a target of the usual suspects, J.P. Morgan, Jacob Schiff, the Rothschilds, and they teamed up with their favorite tool, what history refers to as the anarchists, the radical anarchists, who are looking to upset the ruling order. And so the crime syndicate or the oligarchy, the plutocracy, used these anarchists throughout Europe in the later part of the 1900s for political assassinations. But the McKinley was a strong proponent of sound money. He was opposed to central banking, and he was a protectionist, so he would use tariffs to protect American goods. And he would be best characterized as an American firster nationalist as opposed to an internationalist. And he was very popular and very widely respected. I mean, one frequent opponent of his, Senator John Horror of Massachusetts, acknowledged that McKinley's great wisdom and tact and his delightful individual quality gave him unusual influence. So he was 58 when he died. He was the son of an Ohio iron worker, so he came from modest roots and very popular and capable. He would have been a powerful influence over the subsequent 15 years. He had still had over 3 years in office until 1905, and the central bank was put in play in 1913. So in those 15 years, he would have been in his early 70s, he would have been around as a powerful influence against the crime syndicate's new world order, if you want to call it that. So that's the importance of this assassination. Now let's kind of go through the particulars of how it was done. The assassin's name was Leon Koskos. I can't even pronounce it, so I'm going to go with Leon from now on. I'll refer to him as Leon. He was a Polish Catholic, and he shot McKinley at point-blank range with a covered revolver at the Temple of Music in Buffalo at the Pan American Exposition. It was a really easy operation. He just walked up to him, shot him twice. One bullet kind of missed or was ineffective, but the other one lodged into his gut. So let's kind of go through this in two stages. I think there's two suspects. So let's look at Leon first. Now, the thing that's really strange about this assassin is how quickly they got rid of him. So the assassination was done on September the 6th, 1901. McKinley died 8 days later. They caught this guy right away. Hundreds of witnesses, so there's no doubt that he shot him. But he's sworn to emerita, doesn't say a thing. He offers no defense. This trial takes 8 hours. He's isolated the entire time. And then he's electrocuted on October the 29th, 6 weeks later. His brother comes and asks for the body, but they had meanwhile, first they mutilated his body by throwing a bunch of sulfuric acid on him, put him in a box. His brother comes and says, "No, I want the body." They refused to give him the body. They buried him in an unmarked grave on the grounds of the Buffalo prison. And that was it. Leon just kind of came and went. And I'm asking the question, did he slip out the back door? Because it looks like this Buffalo setup was every bit the same, a lot like Dallas was in 1963. It was a cesspool of conspiracy. So,
yeah, is it common to throw sulfuric acid on bodies of those who are executed?
I have no idea.
I can honestly be practical, other than, you know, trying to hide the identity of the person in the box, right? That's...
Well, if you want to do a DNA study today on the guy, you couldn't find him. He's gone. He's disappeared very quickly. Okay, so the connection is the connection on this thing is he was making contact with a radical anarchist Jewess by the name of Emma Goldman. Now, Emma Goldman is today esteemed as this great feminist and wonderful, you know, revolutionary. I mean, they just kind of, she's like an icon. Well, she had been, she had inspired, supposedly, Leon to carry out this assassination. And she is associated, let me just kind of get my bearings here on this. Okay, so right away after the assassination, the media, when you go back and look at the media at the time, they're kind of on to the scent. Today nobody talks about this. So this is another one of these narratives that's completely disappeared. So even the New York Times, what I call the New York Slimes, did an article on September the 8th, 2 days after the assassination, that says the general theory now held by the detectives is that a circle of Leon's associates plotted the murder of McKinley and that he was picked by lot or induced by persuasion to carry out the conspiracy. They say that he lacks the shrewdness to have planned or executed the crime as he did. And so he has a friend of his that comes on once again in the same New York Times article. So New York Times is doing a good job of reporting this stuff pretty quick. And the narrative doesn't sound normal. It doesn't sound like the fake narrative that we get so often. So he goes, the New York Times goes on, Walter Nowak was brought to the police headquarters this morning. He is a cigar dealer and also a Polish newspaper man in Chicago. He says he knows Leon well and collaborates the statement that the latter was inspired to his cowardly act by Emma Goldman. I know him in Cleveland, said Nowak. He belonged to several secret societies, and one of them was anarchists. I think the idea of assassination had been turning in his mind for some time, as that sort of business is what is taught in the society to which he's belonged. So he's reporting, looking at a secret society as well. So Leon said that he'd met Goldman, Emma Goldman, for the first time during one of her lectures in Cleveland in May. After the lecture, he approaches the speaker's platform and asks for her reading recommendations. Okay, so then on June 2nd, a issue of the anarchist rag Free Society, now keep the name Free Society in mind, appeared a article by Goldman honoring Gaetano Bresci, who had assassinated the king of Italy, Umberto. So she's going around constantly praising these assassins. Are you with me?
Yep. So she's an advocate of political assassination.
Yeah, she's an espoused advocate of political assassination.
And she has ties to the assassin of course, the alleged assassin, or the assassin of McKinley, yeah.
Well, in the beginning, everybody thought she did, mm-hmm. but that just all kind of went away. Now, she was also associated, her boyfriend was a gentleman by the name of Abraham, what was his name? His name is...
Isaac?
No, that's a different guy. You got Alexander Berkman.
Okay.
That's Goldman's lover.
Okay.
Now, Alexander Berkman, during the homestead strike of 1892, shot the industrialist Henry Frick 3 times and stabbed him twice, and Frick survived. So Berkman goes to prison for 10 years. And Berkman was in prison during the McKinley assassination, but once he comes back out, he's right back with Goldman again. So these guys are just killers. They're assassins. They have no compunction about it. And then everybody acts like they're just so wonderful feminists and this and that. It's just amazing. So then in the Free Society, on October the 6th, in an op-ed piece written by, let me back up. So now Leon visits Goldman in Chicago on July the 12th. He's traveling to Chicago. He meets her at the home of Abraham Isaac, the publisher of the Free Society, and introduces himself as Fred Neiman, which means nobody, Fred Nobody. Mm-hmm. Goldman was on her way to the train station. So he only had time enough to explain to her about the disappointment in the Cleveland socialist and for Goldman to introduce him to her anarchist friends who were also at the train station. So then in the Free Society, just before the assassination, this is on October the 6th, Isaac writes an op-ed piece, and he says he noted that yes, indeed, he says, there was a young man who desired to speak to me, and Goldman pointed Isaac Leon out to me. So, but then he goes on and he says that writes another piece. Attention, The attention of the comrades is called to another spy. He is a well-dressed, medium height, rather narrow shoulders, about 25 years old. Up to the present, he has made his appearance in Chicago and Cleveland. In the former place, he remained for but a short time while in Cleveland, he disappeared. When the comrades had confirmed themselves of his identity and were to the point of exposing him, his demeanor is of an unusual sort, pretending to be greatly interested in the cause, asking for names, soliciting aids for acts of contemplated violence. If this same individual makes his appearance elsewhere, the comrades are warned in advance and can act accordingly. I mean, what a ridiculous backstory. You see what he's doing?
Yep.
He's just basically laying out the tracks ahead of time for this assassination to get them kind of in the clear. So the guy handling the investigation of this anarchist group in New York City, he was quoted, his name is Julius Edelstein. He's quoted as saying, no matter how much Leon has been damned for this work. Now, this is another member of their group. No matter how much Leon has been damned for his good work, we know that he was a great man. He's a true hero. So the anarchists are just eulogizing him, talking about how great he was, owning up to, you know, we didn't do it, but it's good that he did this. And so then finally, right before Leon is executed, the warden in Buffalo goes and has a little talk to him, and he says, who gave you the money to go to Buffalo? No one. A man in Chicago wanted to see me, and I went there from Cleveland. What was his name? I don't remember his name. You remember where he lived? I don't remember the streets. So in other words, he acknowledges that he went to visit these people in Chicago. Leon also claimed that when he reached Chicago, a boy who he did not know approached him at the depot and handed him a packet of money. He said that the money was used on the trip, on the Buffalo trip, but that he never knew who sent it to him or the identity of the lad who delivered it. In the warden's interrogation, Leon tried to backtrack on the statement, but soon after the Chicago trip, this penniless drifter somehow purchased a revolver. So that kind of describes the connection to the anarchist. Now, I think where it really gets interesting is on the inside, the inside job aspect of it. Is this making sense?
Oh, yeah. Now, of course, what we have here is you have a money trail. And, of course, the question is, really, if there's an earnest investigation and there is evidence of conspiracy, you would think the authorities would investigate it and follow the money and maybe lead back to the anarchists and ultimately to their paymasters, which is, I think, what you conclude with the article, of course. But go ahead, continue.
Yeah, and they did for a while. I mean, the initial reaction of the public, even the media, was, yeah, it's this anarchist did this. And there was, and Gold Moon was brought in to the grand jury. They questioned her. So they kind of ran her under the gauntlet a little bit, but yeah. Then it just kind of got dropped.
As in all these cases, there's no money in being a revolutionary or being an anarchist unless you have a banker financing you.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, right? I mean, that's one thing. Where do these rags get the money to publish? Right? They have banker financing for whatever reason. Yeah.
Okay, so there's a really interesting character, and I think he's the operative mole within the McKinley administration, and his name is George Cortelyou. Mm-hmm. And Cortelyou was McKinley's personal secretary, or what would now be called the chief of staff. Yeah, I mean, he had a lot of power.
And if I recall, he's the mentor to Bissell?
Other way around. Bissell was his mentor.
Okay. Of course, the Bissells, it would that be the same Bissell family, then, like, who the Senate would be? I think he was the one that was fired during the Bay of Pigs thing. One of the...
Later.
yeah. Probably. It's one of these families. Yeah. Again, we're getting these bloodline families. It's funny because the name Bissell shows up all the time in intelligence and elite circles. And you have Bissell, one Bissell being fired or being purged by Kennedy, I think, over the Bay of Pigs thing in 62. Or 60 and 61.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Makes total sense.
So it's an old line... I think it's an old line Skull and Bones family, so...
Right. This particular Bissell, who was his mentor, his name Wilson Bissell, mm-hmm. and he was a Democrat. So keep in mind that McKinley was a Republican.
Yeah.
And so they got a New York Democrat, political kingpin, and he was postmaster general during the Grover Cleveland term. And he was a member of Yale Skull and Bones, practiced law out of Buffalo. But his law partner was the future President Cleveland. Now, Cleveland was the Democrat before McKinley, mm-hmm. but there were apparently some incestuous relationships here between these two parties, particularly these two wings. And so Bissell's older brother, Arthur Bissell, was the president of the New York State Bankers Association and the president of the People's Bank of Buffalo. So what happened is that Bissell recommended to Grover Cleveland to hire Cortelyou. So that gave Cortelyou his first in as a bureaucrat in the government, as in an advisory role or a secretarial role, if you can call it that, or a staff role, working for Cleveland. So then when Cleveland gave way to McKinley, when McKinley was elected, he recommended this guy, said, this guy would be a great guy for you to be your personal secretary. And Cleveland and McKinley had good relations. He says, okay, yeah, I'll bring him on. I need a good guy. So the politics of the time, you had the Eastern establishment, which was what President Cleveland was part of, and the counter, the anti-plutocratic wing of the Democratic Party was William Jennings Bryan, just to give you the perspective. Mm-hmm. So he goes to work for McKinley, and we could go on the Spanish-American War, but that would detract us probably forever. But I think that essentially Cortelyou was the war party and all that, influencing McKinley towards war. The war itself was declared by Congress, and McKinley just kind of went along because the Congress had dictated the war, and so he said, okay, we got a war. So anyway, if you believe in the incompetence meme or Hanlon's razor, meaning that malice can only be explained away as incompetency, go ahead and turn this interview off and go away. No need to listen any further, because Cortelyou is on hand every step of the way with the bad decisions leading to McKinley's death. So we start out at the exposition. The guy running the exposition is another bankster by the name of Lewis Babcock, and he's made nervous by a joke at lunch that the president might be shot during the reception. So he runs over to, I call him Comedy of Errors Cortelyou, and says, look, we need to bring in, I got a dozen artillerymen out here on the fairgrounds. Let's bring them in here in full dress uniform and have them stand in the aisles. So these guys were not trained in police work, and they just ended up they crowded the area in front of the president and obstructed the view of the real detectives and the Secret Service, made their job more difficult. So that was another Comedy of Errors Cortelyou move. So part of the reason for bringing McKinley to the fair was to swell the gate receipts. And so they really heavily advertised it. Did Cortelyou do anything to prevent the promotion? No. But then after the assassination comes this death protest too loudly backstory that Cortelyou disliked the reception location at the Temple of Music, and supposedly concerned for the president's security, he tried to remove it from the program. So he supposedly talked to the president twice. Well, the president's not around to rebuke that. Nobody's around. It's just another narrative that he makes up. So McKinley goes ahead. He arrives on time, and there's a picture of him, the last picture ever taken of McKinley, and he's standing between a guy named John Milburn, who will come up in a minute. He's the owner of the house where McKinley died. And Cortelyou is standing there right over his shoulder. And then the assassin came in and shot him relatively easy. So now we've got a wounded president. So what does Cortelyou do? Instead of getting him to a real hospital, he takes him into a poorly provisioned medical room located at the exposition. The picture of it is in the article I wrote on this. And so even though McKinley was at the fair, the best surgeon in the city who was the exposition's medical director, Roswell Park, just happened to be away in Niagara Falls performing a neck operation. So when interrupted during the procedure that day, and told he needed to go to Buffalo, he responded, no, I can't leave. I've got to finish up here. I can't even leave for the President of the United States. So now you've got him in this sort of medical hut with very poor equipment, no light. And the first doctor to arrive is named Herman Minter. And then the second guy to arrive is named Matthew Mann. Well, guess what Matthew Mann is?
the second doctor?
Yeah, he's a gynecologist. Okay. Never had any experience in trauma surgery.
Close but no cigar, right?
So. Yeah, right. And needless to say, he's been widely criticized for malpractice and what happened. So they essentially they made an incision and couldn't find the bullet. So they probed with their fingers and hands, and they found the damage to the digestive system, and the stomach showed an entry and an exit wound, and they sewed it all up, but they couldn't find the bullet himself. And so man declared, a bullet, once it ceases to move, does little harm.
Really?
Yeah, that's okay. What he said. So, I mean, you know, if you're familiar with bullet trauma, it carries a lot of problems with it. You know, the material kind of breaks up, and you get into some infection and bacteria, yeah, and things like that. You got to try to get these bullet fragments out. You can't just leave them in somebody's tissue to interact with blood, you know, with the blood. And so there was actually a primitive X-ray machine on display at the fair, but they decided not to use that because they thought it would, quote unquote, disturb the patient. So now we're done with the surgery, and so we've got to take McKinley somewhere to die. And so they took him next nearby to the nearby home. I emphasize the word home, residence of John Milburn, to die, to convalesce. Milburn is a friend of Grover Cleveland and a prominent attorney who represented many high-profile clients, including Standard Oil, the New York Stock Exchange, and Metropolitan Street Railway, and he was later served as president of the New York City Bar Association. So rather than taking him to a hospital, they just took him to sit and get worse for a week. And meanwhile, the same crew of doctors attended to him, Mintner and Mann. They didn't even replace him. Bring Park in.
So they didn't bring in more competent physicians?
No, they didn't take him to a hospital. So the main issue he faced was gangrene from the failure to track the bullet path and find the round. And so to deal with this, Thomas Edison came to the rescue. He sends an X-ray machine accompanied by a trained operator. Did they use it? No. They didn't use it. So he dies 8 days later. You know, he took a turn for the worse on the seventh day. And the guy, they did the autopsy. And the autopsy was done by the same crew, Mintner and Mann. And they found the gangrene growing on the walls of his stomach and toxin passing into the blood, you know, sepsis. And basically that's what killed him. So with him out of the way, with the great William McKinley out of the way, that laid the way for Theodore Roosevelt to become president, Theodore Roosevelt out of New York. And Cordelieu stayed on and became the U.S. Secretary of Commerce and Labor, his combined offices then, in 1903. But then he left the position in 1904 to become chairman of the Republican National Committee. And then he became Postmaster General. And then he became U.S. Secretary of State in 1907, just in time for the Panic of 1907. Aha. Uh-huh. You with me?
Yes. J.P. Morgan's.
Yeah. But first, he had to, as the chair of the Republican National Committee in 1904, he raised what a 1912 investigative report by the San Francisco Call revealed as a monster Wall Street slush fund. And I have the headline right here on my article. It says, Wall Street favored Roosevelt admits monster 1904 slush fund raised by our friend George Cortelyou. He raised the money.
So he was the money man behind Roosevelt's campaign.
He was the chair of the RNC. So he's rewarded just in time for the 1907 panic, which was totally contrived, set up so that J.P. Morgan could be hailed as the savior of Wall Street and the economy, and major parasite looting operation. So then as the banking crisis spread, Cordelieu's master, J.P. Morgan, summoned him to New York to, quote unquote, work by the financier's side. So Cordelieu had already deposited $5 million in banks there to the New York banks to shore them up. And by law, the government could only deposit government funds in national banks such as J.P. Morgan. And it was the trust companies and the state banks that were in trouble. So sly J.P. Morgan instructs Cortoyou to up the ante and deposit $35 million into the national banks. And then Morgan then used the time-tested other people's money on the hook, you know, being on the hook, in which to pick the winners and losers and engage in looting and bargain hunting, and consolidated over $1 billion worth of banks. Just completely consolidated the power of banking in the United States in the hands of fewer and fewer banks. Major consolidation.
Yeah, I think this was, the crisis was started by whispering campaigns, sort of about bank runs, that old trick.
Yeah, yeah, and it ended fairly fast. It wasn't a long depression, so everybody kind of looked at that and said, okay, that was a close call, but, you know, the markets recovered pretty fast. The economy was, it was hit if you were a small banker or you had the wrong creditors, but the overall economy got through it pretty well, so everybody go, wow, look what J.P. Morgan did, you know.
Maestro.
Yeah, maestro. Lender of last resort.
Well, yeah, this sets the stage for the 1910 meeting, you know, because people, serious opinion starts to say, well, we need banking reform. We need something like a lender of last resort, a Federal Reserve. Not a central bank, a reserve bank of 12 regional banks, so it's not really centralized, so they claim. But yeah, this is that meeting over there in North Carolina, Jekyll Island. Yeah, which was a duck hunting trip, supposedly. But
yeah, well, I mean, one of the big cheerleaders after this panic for the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank was our friend George Cortoyou.
Mm-hmm.
So Johnny on the spot, every step of the way, just constantly screwing up, you know, definitely, but I think he's definitely involved with the assassination of McKinley.
Well, why do you have bankers writing banking reform? It's like, it's almost like having lawyers write laws, right?
Yeah, and then Roosevelt didn't institute the Federal Reserve Bank, so we got to give him credit for that. It wasn't quite ready yet. Because he had to have the panic first and a little bit of buildup.
But he did play a big part in getting Taft out of the way in 1912.
Right.
Yeah, but the Bull Moose Party, he was brought in again.
Right, so the narrative being run out there and who the heroes are and who the bad guys and the good guys are is not exactly what it seems. So that kind of takes care of the McKinley case.
Well, one thing, little note that one thing you do have in the article is that apparently... Oh, where is this? There's the cafe that Emma Goldman used to frequent in New York was also a frequent place for Leon Trotsky.
Yeah, same cafe. It was like a cesspool.
Radicals. The takeaway: what's the role of these radicals? These radicals are proxies that are used to destabilize, carry out violence, to create sort of a false dialectic, to bring out an outcome that the oligarchs want. And you could look at these.
Point of the spear is kind of what they are.
Yeah.
That's kind of how they function.
And so they get McKinley out of the way the same way that the Bolsheviks are used to get the Tsar out of the way for the crime syndicate, to simplify matter. You know, obviously, we're talking about the First World War and why folks like Trotsky were funded by the banksters to destabilize Russia.
No. Well, McKinley would have been in their way.
Yeah.
He would have been. He was popular. He was smart. He was well connected. He would have been a problem, you know, because he would have been. He was an American firster. So there's one of your first American firster assassinations. So now we can go to. What do you want to go to? Patton.
Patton's an interesting case. Yeah.
Okay. How are we doing on time?
Oh, we're fine. Good. I'm. My day's free, so go ahead. Don't worry about it until you get tired.
Well, it's the audience I worry about, but anyway. So the Patton case is a little bit more known. I mean, there was Bill O'Reilly's book talks about some of the conspiracy theories, which he just blows off. You know, he does a pretty good job of describing it, and then he comes to the conclusion, he basically comes to the conclusion that he's a Hammond's razors kind of guy. You know, that's the fallback position. Yeah, that's not enough. But the book that's been written on this topic is called Target Patton by a guy named Robert Wilcox. And then his brother, Tim Wilcox, has an interview, worked with him on the book. And I have the nine-minute interview, which kind of gives a good synopsis on what happened. And I think they really did a good job. They failed in one area, which I'll get to later. Where did this thing go?
I mean, most people know Patton as being sort of a firebrand, a thorn in the side of the establishment. And then he's relieves his command and has this unfortunate accident. But there's more intrigue involved in this, and involving post-war Germany and the whole post-war setup because of what's going to happen in Germany. And Patton didn't like what was going on there.
Yeah, let's talk about the motive for the assassination before we get to the assassination, so we can kind of build up to that. Now, one of the narratives out there, and included, everybody seems to buy this narrative because we've all heard it in the movies, and it's just been kind of implanted in our minds, neurolinguistic programming, that Patton wanted to go to war with Russia.
Yeah.
Well, that's a myth. And you have to kind of understand the timeline a little bit to really appreciate it. So what was happening is that Patton was in command of the Third Army and was overrunning mostly southern Germany. And at one point he said, I can go to Berlin. I can take Berlin. We can beat the damn Ruskies. And the deal had already been cut. Don't do that. So he followed orders. He didn't disobey orders. And so they sent him down to Czechoslovakia, kind of that direction, down towards Pilsen and into Bohemia. And so he moved down there and liberated Pilsen, which is about 100 miles out of Prague. And then he wanted to go on to Prague and liberate that city. And they said, no, go back to Germany. Now, if you look at the map, this is like May 1945. And, I live in this region of Europe. The map clearly illustrates that Bohemia is really strategic because it's almost like a salient.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much Moravia because that's too far east, but Bohemia is right south of Leipzig and Dresden and East Germany, what would eventually be East Germany. So whoever took Bohemia really had a key strategic position within Europe. And I think what Patton was arguing is, let me take Bohemia. He wasn't saying, I want to go to war with Russia. That's a lie. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's number one.
Well, it's the same reason why maybe Hitler eyed Czechoslovakia in 1938. Yeah, same.
Yeah, because it's especially for Germany, because it's sort of like a salient in there that it sort of flanks everything. So then the story gets going that the Russians, even the conspiracy theorists like Wilcox, as great a book as he wrote, I mean, I think it's a wonderful book. I would highly recommend everybody reads it. But his conclusion was that the NKVD assassinated, not in the end, they poisoned him when he was in the hospital. Well, that's possible, I suppose. And their guy that kind of snitched on the whole story kind of said it was a Polish guy. He didn't say NKVD. He said it was a Polish guy that came in and administered the coup de grace on Patton. Well, the reason being is that the Russians wanted to get rid of Patton. Well, that's bullshit, because if you go and take a look at the history of the Cold War, because it kind of ties into the Forrestal case too. This is right out of Wikipedia, because it actually has some good little references. Hang on a second. You have the Iron Curtain speech that was made by Churchill.
Mm-hmm.
So Patton was assassinated in December of 45. The Iron Curtain speech was in March of 1946. So right then, he's acknowledging that the Cold War is on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it happened before that. There was a whole series of cables between particularly Churchill to Truman, saying, we're in trouble, man. These guys are just going nuts. This is like in June and July. And so the whole relationship between Russia or the Soviet Union and the West had greatly disintegrated. So they didn't need Patton to tell them anything. All Patton was doing is saying, let me take some strategic locations at the end of the war when it was kind of a scramble for land.
Yeah.
That's all he really did. He didn't, you know, so they created this narrative that he wanted to go to war with the Russians and that the Russians got rid of him because the relations were so great between the Allies and the Soviet Union, where they weren't. They had completely broken down by the middle of 1945. And I was going to just go ahead and read one example after another, but it's not really necessary. You can go to Wikipedia under the Iron Curtain and you can see these accounts. So the historical fact is the Cold War was on almost as soon as Roosevelt died.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as soon as the war was over, it was on. So let's go through.
A lot of people think that's the reason for the dropping of, you know, the atom bombs on Japan was more post-war than it was about the war itself at the time, you know, showing the Russians.
Right, but in terms of the narrative about the assassination of Patton, it's a misnomer.
Mm-hmm.
So what had happened is that Patton was going to write his memoirs, and Patton was wealthy, and he was. Too outspoken.
Yeah, you dropped off that you said Patton was wealthy.
Yeah, and he was going to write his memoirs, and he was outspoken.
Mm-hmm.
So here's I think is the reason for the hit on Patton, and he put these views in a October 22nd, 1945 letter, in a long letter to Major General Harbord, one of his friends. And so once the powers realized that he would retire and be outspoken, the plan was put into place, the car accident. Mm-hmm. So here's what he says in the letter. I have been just as furious at you at the compilation of lies. I'm trying to do the...
You're George Scott. C. Scott.
Yeah, right. I have been just as furious at you at the compilation of lies which the communist and Semitic elements of our government have levied against me and practically every other commander. In my opinion, it is a deliberate attempt to alienate the soldier vote from the commander because the communists know that soldiers are not communistic and they fear what 11 million votes of veterans would do. So he's basically saying, you know, I'm going to go and make a political statement to my veterans.
He's also acknowledging a sort of a Judeo-Bolshevik conspiracy. It's interesting.
Yeah, communistic Judeo-Semitic. He refers to him as Semitic. He never uses the word Jew. It's just always Semitic. It's always that's his term for it. It is my present thought that when I finish this job, which I will be around the first of the year, I shall resign, not retire, because if I retire, I will still have a gag in my mouth. I should not start a limited counterattack. That would be contrary to my military theories. But should I wait until I can start an all-out offensive? He says. So they're probably reading his mail, keeping a real close eye on him. So yeah, he had disagreed about the carving up of Europe big time. But by this time, everybody knew they'd made a mistake. So nobody was really nobody was going to remove Patton because he was outspoken on how Europe got divided up.
And he also, okay. I guess he was also, he came to be very critical of what he was saying about the treatment of the German people, particularly what appeared to have been a sort of a partial implementation of the Morgenthau Plan, you know, with Eisenhower's, Rhein-Meadow camps and some of the other things that were going on in Europe, which don't get reported much, you know, in mainstream narrative of that war.
Yeah, because nobody knows the story of the Rhine-Meadows. It's just amazing because it's just a great big hole in everybody's understanding of the world, what their worldview is. And so how can possibly anybody really, how can O'Reilly, what is O'Reilly doing? Come on, man. He's just selecting certain aspects. Yeah, he didn't get along with the Russians. That's exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't get along with the Russians, but it didn't matter at that point. Nobody was getting along with the Russians. So he wrote on July 21st, he writes to his wife, and there's a whole bunch of, I mean, God, this is like a major read, and I haven't read it, but I've kind of read, I've seen these kind of highlights. He says, "We have destroyed what could have been a good race, and we are about to replace them with Mongolian savages. Now the horrors of peace, pacifism, and unions will have unlimited sway. I wish I was young enough to fight in the next war. It would be real fun killing Mongols. It is hell to be old and passe and know it." And then here's where he's talking about the post-war occupation policy of Germany. "The noise against me is only the means by which the Jews and the communists are tempting and with good success to implement a further dismemberment of Germany. I think that if I resigned as I threatened to do yesterday, it would simply discredit me to no purpose. We promised the Europeans freedom. It would be worse than dishonorable not to see that they have it. This might mean war with the Russians, but what of it? What of it? They have no air force, and their gasoline and ammunition supplies are low." So he's a little bit of a warmonger, but
yeah.
I've seen their miserable supply trains, mostly wagons drawn by beaten up old horses and oxen. I say this: the Third Army alone, with a damn few casualties, could lick what's left of the Russians in 6 weeks. You mark my words. Don't ever forget them. Someday we will have to fight them, and it'll take 6 years, six million lives. So then he says, "Nobody gives a damn how well Bavaria is run. All they're interested in is now is how well it is being ruined."
Mm-hmm.
Evidently, the virus started by Morgenthau and Baruch of a Semitic revenge against all Germans is still working. Harrison, a U.S. Department official, and his associates indicate that they feel German decisions should be removed from houses for the purposes of housing displaced persons. There are two errors in that assumption. First, when we remove an individual German, we punish an individual German, while the punishment is not intended for the individual but for the race. Furthermore, it is against my Anglo-Saxon conscience to remove a person from a house, which is a punishment without the due process of law. And he goes on, he says, I have doubted the expediency of blowing up factories because that the ends for which the factories are being blown up, that is preventing Germany from preparing for war, can be equally well obtained through the destruction of their machinery, while the buildings could be used to house thousands of homeless people. That's kind of fuzzy thinking there.
Frankly, this is part of the Morgenthau plan was called for the deindustrialization, the pasteurization of Germany, and a rapid decrease in the German population. Some people even called for the sterilization of all Germans under the age of 40 to wipe out the population, the German race. And
I see Patton in this statement actually kind of plan. He realizes he's under a lot of political pressure, so he has to kind of come up with lame brain excuses, right? Mm-hmm. Well, why do we want to do that? You know, we can house people there, when really he wanted to sabotage it. You know, he probably saw the Germans as key to the rebuilding of Europe, which eventually people came around to his
point. Well, yes, that's funny because I think in that immediate post-war time, you had two factions within the American ruling elite. One, you know, for lack of a better word, the Dulles pro-Nazi faction, and the Alger Hiss pro-communist faction. And in the immediate years after the war, the Dulles faction won. That's why Alger Hiss was prosecuted in these things. And you had the Cold War because the Cold War, much like the Second World War, was a more or less a planned or fomented crisis to bring about the New World Order, and the Cold War was the next phase. And we're seeing here the contours of the New World Order being established. And at the military, at the Patton level, he's seeing this incongruity or irrationality in policy. He doesn't know quite what to make of it. But he himself was played as a soldier, you know, as a general in that war, in helping destroy European civilization.
Right, because that was his job. But now his job is to, you know, he's trying to pick up the pieces the best he can, I think. You know,
and he's not saying much about the Holocaust, is he?
No, he didn't seem to be any big awareness of that. I said, I'm frankly opposed to this war criminal stuff. He says, it's not cricket and it's Semitic. I am opposed to sending POWs to work as slaves in foreign lands, i.e. the Soviet Union's gulags, where many will be starved to death. I have been at Frankfurt for a civil government conference. If what we're going to do to the Germans is liberty, then give me death. I can't see how Americans can sink so low. It's semantic, and I am sure of it. So semantic revenge he's always referring to.
Mm-hmm.
and communists.
Yeah.
So he kind of goes, he kind of goes on and on. And she says that there's a, right at the end, he says there's a very apparent Semitic influence in the press. They're trying to do two things, implement communism and see that all businessmen of German ancestry and non-Jewish antecedents are thrown out of their jobs. So that's what he's observing. So you can argue whether he's seeing reality or not, but there's a tremendous amount of evidence that's kind of come up, particularly in recent years, with more exposure to the Rhineland Meadows and the Morgenthau policy, that indicates that he was seeing reality. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't paranoid.
Now, you know. And also you point out, you know, his assassination. There was an intelligence officer, OSS agent, who I guess admitted to being involved in his assassination.
Yeah, Douglas DeWitt Bazita admitted it several times, and eventually this Robert Wilcox got him. He's got his files. He got the story from him. And what happened is they set up this fake traffic accident collision as a distraction. Lead around in it that got him right on the third vertebrae. And if you look at the picture up on the screen of the car with the guy standing next to the car, you see it?
I'm not looking at it right now. So
okay, so in that picture, you will see a little tag sticking out of the back window where Patton was sitting. What is that? It's like a little white item there. Well, what happened is that they stopped off at a Roman ruin. He was with General Gay. They were going to go hunting. And they stopped off, looked at the Roman ruin, and came back to the car, and he couldn't roll the window up. It was like a 4 or 5 inch gap in the window in this wintertime, and it was stuck. So you got a gap in the window. They drive on down the road. This truck is going to come veering strangely in front of the car, slams into the car. And Bazada says that I shot him in the third vertebrae of the back of the neck, which is basically a spot that you go for a paralyzing shot.
Yeah.
And the reason the orders came down from OSS Chief William Donovan, who personally ordered the killing of Patton on the grounds that he, quote unquote, gone crazy and was becoming a threat to American national interest. So that's why they carried out the assassination. It obviously came from high levels, probably Truman or somebody. I mean, who knows how this stuff works?
Well, you know, yeah, Marshall or Eisenhower.
Go around. Yeah.
Eisenhower or Marshall, who are largely tools, you know,
right?
For the crime syndicate that orchestrated the war.
So a professional analyst subjected Bazzata's interview to the rigors of content analysis using a psychological stress evaluator. In his report, he says Bazzata gave no evidence of lying. And there's an article that gives more details of it. And then I do have a very good nine-minute synopsis by Tim Wilcox, which you just don't see anywhere. It's just not on the internet. There's not much discussion of this book, although O'Reilly has to address it. He just dismisses it.
Well, a whole element to the events of the day, the war itself, the post-war era, is the Zionist or Jewish interests, which tend to get ignored by the mainstream media as not being instrumental in the outbreak of war and the war's conclusion, because obviously the war played a huge part in fulfillment of the Zionist project, the establishment of Israel.
Well, yeah, it's so bad that even guys like Wilcox that basically see that there's an inside job have to kind of scramble around and come up with this Russian narrative.
Yeah. You know?
Because they can't really name it's the crime syndicate. I mean, I'm not going to say it's just the Zionists. Crime syndicate.
I'm saying they're a big part of the, they're one important faction in this. You know, and so it factors into these events. They have to be placated, or their interests have to be, have to be considered. And one big thing was, of course, in the post-war era, was the creation of Israel. And both world wars, were a big part of that. And you have people, characters like Bernard Baruch, who played a big part, of course, in the First World War, but even during the 30s, leading up to the Second World War. And so, yeah, it's just one of these things. It's a series of when you say it's a crime syndicate, it's a syndicate. It's various factions that have gotten together and organized to see that their interests are achieved through nefarious, illegal, and secretive means, you know.
The bottom line on this one is we don't want loudmouth Patton criticizing us.
You can't have free agents offering honest opinions and based on observation or experience. Everything has to be controlled, obviously if low ranking people are irrelevant, they can spout off or they just won't be promoted. But if you have an important person like a Patton or a Forrestal, which we'll get into, these are serious threats to the New World Order, because they have the capacity to alert the public,
to the truth. Right, exactly. So, all right, so Patton's in trouble. He's still alive, obviously, but he's getting smashed up pretty good. He kind of hit the glass in front of him, compared to glass separation between the seats in front. The general next to him was completely untouched, didn't even scrape anything. And so the car was being driven by a corporal who just then completely disappeared. Nobody even knows who was driving Patton's car. It's just like, and it wasn't his regular driver. So all of a sudden, this guy shows up and then disappears.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, yeah. Of course, the car accident itself is a standard intelligence way of carrying out an undercover assassination.
Yeah, this was an interesting one. Having his door open, having his window open, and popping him with some special made.
I mean, good example is how this is part of tradecraft, if you will. Do you remember, I think years later, of course, G. Gordon Liddy writes about how he was thinking of taking out Anderson, the reporter, Anderson, G. Gordon Liddy talked about how they had talked about trying to assassinate, remember that reporter from the 70s, Anderson, what was his name? Was it Anderson? Yeah, Anderson, and using a car accident in one of the circles in Washington, D.C. to do it.
Yeah. They vary their methods. Now they could just give you a heart attack.
Push you down the stairs,
Shoot you in the butt with some kind of dart, whatever. Yeah. I don't know what they're doing now.
Defenestration, right? As we'll get into Forrestal.
So the trade, unfortunately, the trade craft is really advanced now. No doubt about it. And that's what's spooky about this stuff.
Yeah.
So they took him to, rather than taking him to the nearby Mannheim hospital, they drove him up to Heidelberg. So they kept him on the road like another half hour longer than he even should have been. And then he gets in the hospital and they fit him with a bad neck brace that did more harm than good. And so eventually some, legitimate medical, just like the McKinley case.
Yeah.
Eventually, some legitimate medical attention shows up and goes, "What are you doing with this neck brace on? This is a joke." And he takes it off and gets him properly fitted. But he was just about ready to die right there before he was just miraculously rescued. And keep in mind that actually they tried to shoot McKinley Patton down earlier. He was flying in a Cub Piper. And a Polish British Spitfire came out of Poland and tried to shoot him down, and he only got out of it because he had an exceptional pilot that really knew his stuff, in terms of evasion. So the guy was able to evade a Spitfire flying a Piper Cub.
Really? I didn't know about that.
Yeah, they got, and then there was another attempt to get in. There's two previous attempts to assassinate him. They were after him continually, and he was like an amazing ability to avoid assassination. So then he's recovering after the proper medical care finally showed up, and he held a press conference, says, "I'm going to go home." And that is when he was injected or poisoned in the hospital and died suddenly on December 21st, 1945. And then you got the backstory, the NKVD agents got him, which I don't agree with. Bezada claims he knows who's killed him, and he refers to him as a Pole. And he was killed. He says that Patton was killed by a dose of cyanide in the hospital. But nobody knows because there's no autopsy done. Mm-hmm. So there's really no investigation done. And all the official records, there's several official records were produced regarding the strange traffic accident, but all the reports have completely disappeared from government files. The medical records have disappeared. The archival records are scrubbed. And we've got sort of that same pattern. I think it's almost like a template even from the McKinley case.
Yeah, so missing documents. You think there'd be this stuff would be archived and preserved for just for its historical importance. Yet the it seems to be the trail was wiped clean. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that's Patton. So we can move on to James Forrestal.
Yeah, who was James Forrestal?
Well, he was the assistant secretary of the army, I believe it was, in throughout World War II. He was not a pacifist, so that wasn't the reason they got him was not he wasn't opposed to the military industrial complex. In fact, he was kind of arguing to maintain strong military strength. He was U.S. Navy Undersecretary starting in 1940.
Yeah. Well, these guys are examples of people that are within the system that tell us that at this time the system wasn't completely locked down. There's men of goodwill who are working within the system who then have to be taken care of. Yeah. So.
Right. So this is a little bit more of a, again, America firster. He was Secretary of Defense from 1947 to 1949. And so he was another guy that urged the hard line against the Soviets, but that wasn't too unusual. And then he strongly influenced Senator Joseph McCarthy on his investigations into infiltration of the government by communists. So that got him on a shit list there.
Mm-hmm.
Jim McCarthy said, "Before meeting with Jim Forrestal, I thought we were losing to international communism because of incompetence and stupidity on the part of our planners. I mentioned that to Forrestal. I shall never forever remember his answer. He said, McCarthy, consistency has never been a mark of stupidity. If they were merely stupid, they would occasionally make a mistake in our favor," end quote.
Yeah, that's one of the greatest quotes I love.
Right. It's like the Hamlin's razor thing again.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because figures like this, like Forrestal, even McCarthy, who some people say was kind of urged on by Hoover, who wanted to go after things like the newly formed CIA and also the Army. This is more of a bureaucratic thing. But they were detecting some sort of infiltration or subversion. And, of course, the immediate suspect is the Soviet Union and international communism. What they didn't understand is at a higher level, at a meta level, international communism was part of a Judeo-Masonic plan of the New World Order that had been launched decades before. This is why during the Russian Revolution you had key support being given to the Bolsheviks by London and New York. And why, if you look at put it in the context of the Reese Committee hearings and the investigations that were exposed about the use of foundations and supporting communist pro-communist groups, but also a cultural subversion, and it's all part of this sort of promoting cultural Marxism that it isn't necessarily East versus West. Is actually Bolshevism itself was an importation from the West to subvert Russia. So that's sort of at a meta level here, but I think we can forgive people like Forrestal, even McCarthy, for not really understanding this at the time and seeing it as sort of a red scare, right, thing.
Yeah, and of course at the time the Soviet Union was a real threat.
Yeah, yeah.
Security threat. I mean, they had given them half of Europe, for heaven's sake. But they should have thought of that in 1941, war.
They couldn't look at a map.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, if we...
At some point in time, somebody should have been negotiating with the Nazis like 43, 44, hard.
Oh, yeah. Same with Japan, because even after Midway, and obviously Japan's gamble had failed. They didn't knock out U.S. military power and they lost the initiative, the offensive initiative in the Pacific. Same with Germany after Stalingrad, it was clear. But they, the plan was total destruction of German power.
Yeah, that was exactly it. I don't think that any of these guys in Germany in 1944, when they knew it was up, would have had a chance even with negotiations. What could they do? I mean, that's the real hidden history that needs to be dug into. Could the last year of the war have been prevented?
All that bombing. Think about all the I mean, most of the destruction in Europe, at least in Western Europe, the war in Russia was a whole other thing.
And then the overrunning of all Eastern Europe by the Soviet Union. So that's what now after the war, they're all they got themselves all into skizzy fit over the Russian Soviet Union's occupation of half of Europe.
Yeah, and the destruction of Western Europe was a product of Allied liberation, really, because really in 40, when the German forces ran over, it had been so quick, there's very little infrastructural destruction. Cities were still intact. But really, it was the liberation of Europe from the Nazis by the Allies, the firebombing,
they kind of forced the Nazis into a last stand mentality that I think was probably unnecessary. And they could have just cut a deal with these assassins, in 44, they've been working with them. Sure, you get rid of Hitler, get rid of this regime.
Yeah.
They've got to go. And then we'll sit down and we'll have a peace. And we'll save Poland. We'll restore Poland. Some kind of an ante. We'll keep Germany relatively intact.
But you wouldn't have a Cold War and all the money that was spent.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I just wonder about all that.
Oh, yeah.
That whole period in there. Maybe I just don't get it. So now we've got Forrestal really stepping into a pile of poo, so to speak. And he's having cabinet meetings with Truman. And the big issue now is Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And he favored a federalization plan for Palestine. And at first, Truman concurred. But then Truman received threats to cut off campaign contributions from wealthy donors, as well as hate mail and an assassination attempt.
That's right. He was offered lead or gold, right?
Yeah, and then there was like a crew went on the White House lawn and kind of shook him up, right? Almost got his daughter or something. I don't know.
Well, this is the crime. People don't realize the formation of the Israeli state, the Zionist cause, how integrated it was with organized crime figures like Meyer Lansky and people that really, Murder Incorporated. And the whole Jewish crime syndicate was mobilized for this effort right after the war, stealing, turns out, even nuclear secrets. But apparently they got hold of B-17 bombers and stealing war material and shipping illegally to the Zionist forces in Palestine. And none of them were ever prosecuted. I think it was the Hank Greenspan, the editor out there in Las Vegas, who was a proud Zionist agent, who ended up being fined like $100,000. He made like $1 million off the project. There's a lot of money being made too in the process. It was a business venture. So there was a huge network that was never fully investigated. In fact, when people try to investigate it, well, people get into that's a whole dimension to the JFK assassination his confrontation with Zionist power. But anyway, go ahead with Forrestal.
Well, Forrestal family and his brother and his wife and hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I lost you for a couple. You start off with Forrestal again.
Okay, so Forrestal states to Howard McGrath, senator from Rhode Island, he says, quote, "No group in this country should be permitted to influence our policy to the point it could endanger our national security." So he's speaking as an America Firster. And so this is the revealing. I'm going to read through this segment right here because it gives the frame of reference for what got him in trouble and what he was thinking. This is February the 3rd, 1948. Now, he was assassinated in 49. Okay, visit today from Franklin D. Roosevelt Jr., who came in with a strong advocacy of a Jewish state in Palestine that we should support the United Nations decision, quote unquote. I pointed out that the United Nations had made no decision, quote unquote, and that there was only a recommendation of the General Assembly, and that I thought the methods that had been used by people outside the executive branch of the government to bring coercion and distress on other nations in the General Assembly bordered upon scandal. I said I was merely directing my efforts to lifting the questions out of politics, that is, to have two parties agree that they would not compete for votes on the issue. So, in other words, no Jewish money influence.
Mm-hmm.
He said this is impossible, which is right, that the nation is too far committed and that, furthermore, the Democratic Party would be bound to lose and the Republican Party gain by such an agreement. I said I was forced to repeat to him what I had said to Senator McGrath in response to the latter's observation that our failure to go along with the Zionists might lose the states of New York, Pennsylvania, and California, and that I thought it was about time that somebody should pay some consideration to what whether we might not lose the United States.
Yes. I mean, that's so funny because right now we're seeing sort of the infiltration, I would say sort of the occupation of the U.S. government by foreign interests that has always been the problem. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fait accompli. You don't have these conversations anymore. No. These conversations are not even happening. They happened then.
I mean, this is why
this is why he's dead.
Yeah, this is why. Well, because, you know, if you're in the Congress and Bibi Netanyahu shows up to give a speech, you are ordered to give a standing ovation 29 times.
Right.
Unless you lose your funding or you get, you know, and that's what the, you know, that's what the AIPAC is all about, you know, which is a foreign, you know, they still haven't registered yet, but they represent Israel in America, and they are funded by Israel. They, you know, the way it's funded is America doles out billions in subsidies to Israel, and some of it gets kicked back to the United States to support, you know, the politics or influence politics here in the United States to continue the funding, which is all borrowed by the banks at interest, which is interesting.
Yeah. So then he goes on in this next entry and says, I had lunch. So they're sending their lobby. The Zionist lobby is showing up, trying to convince him. They're coming into his office. Mm-hmm. I had lunch with Bernard Baruch. After lunch, I raised the same question with him. He took the line of advising me not to be so active in this particular matter. And that I had already been identified to agree that it was not in my own best interest with opposition to the United Nations policy of Palestine, which, you know, it was already, as you said, it was just contrived. Wasn't even a policy yet.
And they're creating a fait accompli. And at the same time, those who are voicing skepticism are getting not so veiled threats.
Right. So anyway, after the lobbying attempt, next what happened is a campaign of unparalleled slander was launched in the United States press and periodicals against Forrestal.
Well, some things never change, do they?
Yeah. It was led by the notorious rumor and Jewish gossip monger Walter Winchell, and I have an article on him.
Yeah, and you also, in the article on Forrestal, you introduce it with a story of Bobby Ray Inman, who in the 1990s, although he wasn't thrown out a window, he was ostracized for just acknowledging the influence or involvement of Israeli spies and intelligence and affecting.
He made some really strong statements. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised he lived.
Yeah, it's amazing how just since the 90s how things have changed in that regard.
Yeah, so they've got them vetted now. They don't even take chances on people like Inman. You know, these are the old school guys, the guys that were in World War II and sort of the old America. My father's generation, those kind of guys. So Winchell's a hatchet man, liar, and then this Drew Pearson went after him. And so then in January 1949, Pearson related that Forrestal's wife had been the victim of a holdup back in 1937 and falsely suggested that Forrestal had run away, leaving his wife defenseless.
Oh, really?
What a story. I don't know. Maybe it's true. I don't know. But it seems like, well, what a story.
Going back to 1937?
I'm really going to go back in the past and dig shit up. So that on March 22nd, 49, he resigned as Secretary of Defense. However, and again, this is like Patton.
Mm-hmm.
He was a wealthy man and was planning on starting a journalistic endeavor with America First leanings.
Hmm. So again, we have the threat of a man of means, of independence, whose opinions vary from the agenda of the oligarchy, the crime syndicate, and again, that's therein lies the threat, because again, his opinion matters, because he's able to give it a certain voice to the American public. So
right, exactly, and so then a few days later, as soon as he makes this announcement, he resigns and makes this announcement. The claim is made that he quote unquote had a nervous breakdown, denied by his brother. And so they take him. He's not even in the government anymore. He's a private citizen. You know, I believe, I don't know, maybe, I'm not clear if he had like a resignation date or what it was, but for some reason they got him into Bethesda Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of a loose end I'd be curious about, is how do you take a private citizen into Bethesda Hospital? But maybe technically he was still Secretary of Defense and finishing out his agreement or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe they did it that way. Just, why don't you hang around, James, just long enough for us to hospitalize you? And so he's administered narcosis with sodium amphetol and a regimen of insulin. According to the assigned doctor, the patient, quote unquote, overreacted and was thrown into a confused state with a great deal of agitation and confusion. Well, the insulin is what they use. They use that for their mind control.
Yeah, overreacting could be a natural reaction to an intentional overdose of something.
This is standard MK Ultra stuff. Yeah. I've written a lot about this particular drug and insulin. It's kind of what they did in the early days of MK Ultra, up there with Ewan Cameron.
Yeah, something saying he overreacted to the LSD, drink we gave him. That's
like... So ultimately, Forrestal fell, quote unquote, from a 16-story window at Bethesda Naval Hospital. And then Drew Pearson ran more phony lies that Forrestal had made four previous suicide attempts, which is a lie. Another dubious Jewish, quote-unquote, historian, Arnold Rogal, continued the fictitious account of his death and character assassination with the well-worn anti-Semitic nut and paranoid conspiracy theorist accusation. Rogal's travesty is a case study in lies and hatchet jobs, and it can be read here. It is sickening! Scott!
So basically, his anti-Semitism was his opposition to the U.S. government recognizing the illegal founding of the Israeli state.
Yeah, but God, the degree of how they go after these guys is very much revealed in this book.
And recognizing that there's a network of mobsters and agents that were undermining the U.S. government, bribing, blackmailing, even murdering people if they opposed them, that's when you become the conspiracy nut. Even though history is born out, that's exactly what was happening.
But you got these mouthpieces in academia and the media, too.
But it had to have been a conspiracy because it didn't happen by... It just didn't just happen. It was active. You know, obviously there was agency here. There were Jewish, there were Jewish agents. They were carrying out an illegal arms shipment, and all these things were illegal. So it is a conspiracy because you have more than, you have two or more men or people conspiring to do something illegal and immoral behind the scenes. So it is a conspiracy. But if you point out this network, and now that network is now written about and bragged about in academic text and mainstream books, but it's after the fact. So now it's considered
heroic. Actually, in this case, there was in 2004, there was a report, it's called the Wilcutt Report, that was finally declassified. So finally, they got in and declassified after 53 years and exposed these fabricators, particularly the fabricators. The Wilcutt Report really went after them, the liars about the character assassination, even though it kind of comes to the final. So it's like a fallback position. They go with fallback positions. Yeah, these guys really did a number on him, but, you know, he threw himself out the window somehow. Still went with that narrative.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the O'Reilly narrative, too. O'Reilly if you read his book, it's a pretty good book of detailing a lot of details and particulars, but it's just the conclusion that he comes up with. And same with the Wilcutt Report. So, but it's a good report. I mean, just skullduggery and storytelling, it does expose that.
Yeah, I just makes you think also of Frank Olson's story, right?
Yeah. And so actually, the smoking gun connection in this report, which I read, nobody's reading this stuff, Tim. Just weirdos like me. It says that his care was administered by MK Ultra psychiatrist Winfred Haberholzer, who signed off on the report. And so... hospital in Washington, D.C.
St. Elizabeth's?
Yeah.
You cut out there for a second. St. Elizabeth is notorious tied
to MK Ultra. And voluntary psychiatry, LSD research, truth drugs, mind control network, And one of his more sensitive cases during his tenure was the poet Ezra Pound.
Yes, yeah.
Who was illegally committed for Axis and anti-Semitic sympathies during World War II, and John Hinckley Jr. So it just kind of goes on. So a little more detail. Okay, coming up to his unfortunate fall, his brother Henry kept trying to get into the hospital, and he refused visiting rights both by Dr. Raines and by the acting hospital commander Hogan. He finally managed to see his brother briefly after he informed Hogan that he intended to go to the newspapers and that he threatened legal action against the hospital. Henry Forrestal stated that when he was finally allowed to see his brother, he found him acting and talking as sanely and intelligently as any man I've ever known.
Hmm.
So he said he tried to get Raines to allow his Forrestal's friend and Catholic priest, Father Morris Sheehy, to visit. And Raines turned Sheehy away on six separate occasions. I don't think Sheehy ever did get in to see him. And so despite the difficulties that people close to Forrestal had in gaining access, Zionist minion and water boy Congressman Lyndon Baines Johnson saw Forrestal in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay.
Why? They're not friends.
Well, Forrestal, I guess...
they didn't even like the guy.
Well, I guess maybe to deliver a message.
Yeah, you can walk out of here now if you shut up. Otherwise, we're going to throw you out the window.
Mm-hmm.
And Forrestal, being kind of a hard-headed personality, told him to go screw himself. I'm sure that's what happened. And so Lyndon said, okay, we'll arrange it for you. So it kind of tells you what happens if you stand up too much.
Yeah, you'll get an offer you can't refuse. So,
but you know, you probably get pissed off after being smeared. You know, it just kind of make some people dig in more. I mean, I don't know what the strategy is on somebody like Forrestal. You smear him, you kind of run this operation against him and get him even more angry.
Yeah, more and also they bring in the UFO story or something.
Oh yeah,
it's another tactic. Yeah.
Yeah, that's just another lie diversion thrown in there.
Because if you're telling this otherwise, you know, this assassination thing is even a normie could understand. Oh yeah, I can understand that. But then you bring in the UFO story, the alien thing, and that sort of smears the whole conspiracy theory thing. You know, then they
right.
you know that's an old tactic. You mix throw that into the mix.
Yep, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's exactly right. So that covers three, I think, pretty important assassinations in the near past. And I suppose we could leave it at that. This is a lot to digest. We've been going an hour and a half, and maybe come back at a later date on Kennedy, John F. Kennedy Jr. I could do a little more preparation on that. And the
Wellstone?
Wellstone, yeah.
Accident?
Right.
Yeah, because they both involve small planes, and that's an interesting.
But the articles are. I do have the articles on both of those on the side. If people are chomping at the bits to get into those, so.
Yes, and Wellstone, of course, an example of a Jewish target.
Yeah.
Who's not?
Yeah, on board. He'd married a goy.
Yeah, he defeated Rudy Boschewitz, who was a.
And Judy Boschewitz was Jewish himself, and his Rudy. Freudian slip there. Rudy
Boschewitz.
and a group of his Jewish friends concocted a letter that they sent out to the Jewish community in Minnesota, criticizing Wellstone for not being a true, you know, to selling out.
Yeah.
And that lost the election for Rudy because it got into the press, and Paul Wellstone says, so I guess he doesn't like Christians, huh?
Well, yeah, they don't want to get into that. Yeah,
but Paul Wellstone's a really good one. I mean, he was a great guy. He really was. And he was Jewish, like you say.
Yeah.
But so nobody's – in fact, I would say a guy like that is even more vulnerable. That's the problem.
Oh, he's straying away from the tribe. Yes, that's
That's why they've got these people locked down so well. That you very rarely see very many Jews really stepping up to the plate. You know, and they're either ignored. I mean, I've got a story to tell you on that front. I have a niece that's kind of, you know, kind of into this liberal San Francisco scene. Mm-hmm. And talking to her, and she says, well, and some of the stuff about the Jews came up, and mm-hmm. she's saying, well, you know, I have lots of Jewish friends, and they're great. Says, they're pro-Palestinian? I am too. Really? How much influence do they have? Well, not much. And then she says, I have one friend. She's into all the, you know, the gay, lesbian issues and all the liberal causes, and it's very pro-Palestinian. In fact, she was pro-Palestinian that the Jewish organizations tracked down and fired her husband, her father, who was a rabbi.
Wow. Well, that's the network. It's the power of the network.
Yeah, they basically, she's doing pro-Palestinian activism. She's Jewish. Her father gets fired from his rabbi position for not keeping her in line. And I said to my niece, I said, well, they'll go after her before they go after you. Mm-hmm. But congratulations for being active on this stuff.
Yeah.
She's just like 18 and wild-eyed.
Yeah, Well, I mean, the takeaway from this, of course, is we're talking about the use of political assassinations to take out inconvenient figures or figures that prevent a stumbling block to the agenda of the crime syndicate, the New World Order, if you will. There are a few other examples I can point out, like Enrico Mattei, who is head of the Italian Petroleum Agency, and he had negotiated deals in the 50s with oil-producing countries that undermined the plans of the then Seven Sisters. And also would have basically been a more equitable dealings with these countries that would might ultimately lead to their actual development as opposed to their exploitation. And of course, his plane blows up. You know, yeah, and another example is Alfred Herrhausen, the German banker in the late 80s, who had broached the topic of debt forgiveness or relief for the third world countries, a new model for development. And he's targeted for assassination by the Red Faction or something. Of course, the Red Army Faction, this German terrorist organization, supposedly communist, but if you're familiar with the story of Gladio, we know that we just can't take that at face value. That very well could have been a Gladio hit because he was another person who was had a Deutsche Bank, he was a Bilderberger, man within the system, but he's entertaining ideas, you know, like a Forrestal, you know, like a Patton. They're soldiers in the system, but they're representing an alternative view, or at least they have the power to perhaps to have these ideas and then promote them in the public, and that's not quite what the crime syndicate wants. So they're taken out, you know. So then that's it's a interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's very widespread. I kind of wonder what's going to happen to Tulsi Gabbard. I mean, she's very you know anything about her?
Oh yeah, sure. She's from Hawaii and all that. She's a supposed.
I'm concerned about her. Yeah. I mean, I hope that she stays safe because she's. She looks to be like another one of these Wellstone types.
Well, I mean, if that's the case, then, you know, a lone nut, I mean, I don't want her to, but, you know, might have her in his sights. This is how these things are pulled. You know, if you look at history, if you examine these things, that's how these things are done. And, you know, when you have a mockingbird media that no one investigates stuff, or you have, you know, the authorities, the police are supposed to investigate these things, have no interest in following the trail, then you can very easily pull these things off. You know.
Yeah. Well, the Wellstone and JFK Jr. hits were, I think, to clear the way for 9/11. Wellstone was after 9/11, and he was going to. He was talking about something's wrong with 9/11. He was talking to his constituencies.
You can't have a U.S. senator saying that. It's fine to have someone on the internet, you know, with a YouTube page or a web page saying those things, even a professor.
Well, he was the swing vote. He was the swing vote in the Senate.
Yeah.
To the Democratic Republican majority, so he had all kinds of reasons for going after him.
Yeah, he claims he was threatened by Dick Cheney too, wasn't he?
Yes. Yeah. We'll get into it.
Okay. Well, I'll let you go. Let you enjoy the rest of your afternoon. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thanks. Bye bye.
That's Russ Winter, and I'll post this one. I'll send you the link.
See ya.
Take it easy. Bye bye.